This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again to discuss this past week's important news with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
One of the clearest end time prophecies of the Bible, corroborated by dozens of different scriptures, shows the decline and fall of the United States. We have a few stories to start the program this week illustrating how this is happening and how it could happen. First, in an announcement that shocked many people and that has many ramifications and ripple effects, United States President Donald Trump said America will withdraw all its forces from Syria. He declared victory over the Islamic State. He said it's time to bring our troops home. To help us unpack the effects of this announcement, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
Yeah, this decision definitely was a shocker for everybody, including the other members of the anti-Islamic State coalition that the United States is fighting with, Europeans, France, others, UK, that are still fighting the Islamic State. So Islamic State still does exist in Syria. While they have been on the run for a while, there definitely are in existence there. It also shocked everybody, or many, I would say, many Republicans, senators, Republicans, they were blindsided by this. They didn't know it was going to take place. It looks like some of the security officials, such as Mr. Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, Mattis, and Bolton, knew about it maybe a couple of days in advance. But everybody else was absolutely shocked by this decision by the United States to pull out. Mr. Trump, right now, obviously he campaigned on this promise that he wanted to bring the troops home from Syria, but then he did surround himself with some really good generals, some really good advisors, and they really did encourage him to keep those 2,200 troops there because they perform not just an important function in the destruction of ISIS, but also as a counter to Iran, the Syrian regime, and Russia. But now that the United States is deciding to go, it looks like it's going to be a bit of a free-for-all in Syria.
Well, there's a whole lot to talk about here. Obviously, there's the aspect of just the way that these announcements are being made, where you have now several lawmakers on Capitol Hill who are openly criticizing the president. You have General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, who has resigned over this, where there just seems to be a real disarray and a lack of coordination just within the administration. We could talk about that. Maybe we could just talk about that a little bit before we move on to say what this means within the Middle East. Andrew, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, this is because General Mattis is just a pillar of kind of what you'd consider the military establishment, just managing all these overseas military bases and protecting America's interests around the world. He's been doing it his whole career. And so you can see that he's definitely concerned that this is going to create a power vacuum. Iran could move in. Russia could move in. America's going to lose influence in the Middle East. It's going to lose control over oil trade routes. It's going to hurt its alliances with other nations that are working in there. So he's definitely against this, and that's why he did his resignation. I guess they're saying that he, even the day President Trump made this announcement, he came in with his resignation letter already printed, but still spent time trying to talk him out of this before he presented the letter and then had his department print 50 copies for distribution around the office. Now, I guess just rambling on here a bit longer. I mean, you can see this is just a quintessential example of how you just can't get it right when you're running a nation God is against. In that President Trump is balancing different interests, because there's a lot of people on his base that are saying, like, says we're throwing millions and billions of dollars into the Middle East and still can't afford a border wall.
Right.
We need to be taking, as our finances, the national debt gets bigger, the deficit gets bigger, our finances get tighter, we need to be taking the resources we're putting into our military to protect our own borders instead of borders halfway across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And with dwindling financial resources, they may have a point, but that doesn't mean that the America's interests in the Middle East are any less significant. So President Trump's trying to figure out, like, how do I manage this when half my base wants me to take troops out of the Middle East and send them to Mexico, the other half wants me to keep bases around the world. We've got interest in both places. Money's tight, and he made his decision, and I can see the logic behind his decision. I can also see the logic behind General Mattis's decision.
Well, so looking at the situation in the Middle East, and Andrew alluded to some of these things, those issues that gave James Mattis pause in looking at the ramifications of this decision, what do we see going forward?
Well, it is, I mean, there's a reason there's a lot of smart people that are very angry about this, because considering bang for your buck, 2,200 troops to pay for them to be there is absolutely nothing for the value that they were on the ground. These American troops were supported by, supporting the Kurdish forces in the north and east of the country. The Kurds are one of the main groups of fighters that were actually fighting against the Islamic State. They were the ground force of the United States against the Islamic State in Syria, basically. And now that the U.S. is pulling out, they're pulling out of their mission with them. They're no longer going to be embedded with Kurdish forces, which will open up them for Turkey. Turkey obviously doesn't like the Kurds. The Kurds wanted to establish their own state in part of Syria. That's not going to happen now. Turkey's already said that they're going to start burying Kurdish forces in their ditches. That's what they said, I think, yesterday after this decision. It's also very worrying that the reporting coming out of Turkey right now, although that can be taken with a grain of salt, they're saying that the phone call that kind of made this decision possible from Mr. Trump happened between him and Mr. Erdogan. And he basically said, Erdogan said, hey, you can outsource the fight against Islamic State to us. We'll take care of him so you can bug out. And then, you know, Mr. Trump is out. So you could look at it that way, that the Kurds are going to be affected by this, and the Kurds are a strong American ally that could definitely push back against Iranian-Syrian hegemony there in Syria, northern Iraq. But then also, America operates the El-Tanf base. This is a really critical base that's right on the border between Syria and Iraq. On one side, on the Iraqi side, on the Iraqi territory, on one side of the base, you have Shiite militias that answer to Iran. And on the other side of the base, you have more Shiite militias and the Syrian regime. And they have wanted to link up these forces. The Iranians want to link up these forces. And the Americans have been standing right in the way for 2 years, basically preventing the establishment of a Shiite superhighway from Iran all the way across to Lebanon. There's a 55-kilometer radius that Americans have said nobody's allowed to come into this zone. And so they have pretty much by themselves created this roadblock. And so now they're going to be pulling out of there. Everyone is worried that Iran is getting what they want. They've wanted this roadway, the Shia Crescent, which we've talked about, and the Americans were preventing it. While America's mission there was to fight ISIS, all of the people that are now up in arms over this decision realize that it's because America has lost an important strategic chess piece in degrading Iran's power in the Middle East. Everyone, Votel, the commander, CENTCOM commander, just visited the base, I guess, a couple of months ago, and he said, "Hey, we're here for Islamic State, but Iran's the real reason that we're staying in this base." And he was apparently furious over this decision as well, that the United States is pulling out. And so this really does open up the way for Iran to control the large swath of territory, again, from Tehran all the way across to Lebanon, through which they could send arms, through which they can send troops. And so, again, just 2,000 men the United States had, but it was accomplishing so much, especially for Israel. The Prime Minister has called Mr. Trump twice over this decision in the past few days. The first time, just before he announced it, trying to say, hey, this is really serious for us. Please don't do it. Mr. Trump reportedly said, I've made my mind up. I'm doing it. Tough bickies. And so then he called him again today over this to try and see, hey, can we work together more? What other ways? Is this it? Are you still going to help us with Iran? And so Israel is really upset by this as well.
It seems like the overall effect that we can expect to see is we've been talking about the United States withdrawing its presence from the Middle East for quite some time and the effects that that would have. As we look at the picture within biblical prophecy, we see Iran's ascendance. We also see, as we've been talking about a lot lately, this expected break between Iran and Syria. And so this seems to say... You have to look at that again and say, well, what is going to happen here? But the other thing that we've talked about is in the absence of an American presence there, a strong American presence in the Middle East, it is Europe that eventually is going to step up and actually take charge and do its level best to put Iran back in its place. So you wonder if Iran does gain some ground here in getting that foothold back in Syria that it's been losing, as we've been talking about in recent months, if that wouldn't precipitate stronger movement on the part of Europe as a means of putting them back in their place.
For sure. And I think one of the big takeaways from this is that you're going to have at least in terms of a prophetic ally of Europe, Turkey is prophesied to be an ally of Europe. They are going to be in a far stronger position to act at will against the Kurds in eastern Syria. And so that's very important. I also just read a piece just before we recorded, somebody from EU Observer, as an opinion piece, but they're saying that, hey, America's getting out. This is like an easy way now for Germany and France to move in and have a stronger military presence inside Syria to make up for where the United States will make up from there, maybe even their base taking over that. And so this is something to really look forward to, look at this situation as something that might come out of it. We do expect, based on Bible prophecy, for Syria to fall out of Iran's sway. Whether that is right now, I can't see it being right now. Laws or Bible prophecy also talks about Iran having a very powerful presence to push at Israel. And so we might see in the immediate sense, Iran maximizing this through and sending as many weapons and forces into Syria as they possibly can when the United States leaves. And then we could also see maybe perhaps a little bit further down the line, Europeans being motivated to get involved just because they've got so much at stake. The Europeans are the ones that feel threatened most about the disruption in Syria because of refugees and such. And if Turkey starts killing off the Kurds, that's we're going to send a whole another wave of refugees up into the north to try and get away from Turkey. So they've got a lot to be concerned about here as well.
It's just a remarkable situation to keep our eyes on. And Brent has written an article that is up on thetrumpet.com. Please do check that out, America's Withdrawal from Syria and the Middle East. He does a very good job of looking at all of the various aspects of what is going on here. In light of what we've been talking about for quite some time, America withdrawing from that part of the world really does have huge ramifications. We appreciate that, Brent. As the U.S. looks to draw down its presence in the Middle East, a sobering report about a crippling security threat to America here at home. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, America still does have the most powerful military in the world and in the history of the world, but it's not as invincible as most people think. All the way back in 1995, our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, ran an editorial in the January issue of The Trumpet that year entitled America's Achilles Heel, where he mentions that our military's main vulnerability is its over-reliance on technology. And then in that article, he mentions a lot of the possibilities that could happen if an enemy weaponized cyber warfare against the American military. But the Air Force came out with a report this November, last month, making another the same point that the military is vulnerable to technology sabotaging measures, but highlighting some different technology sabotaging measures, specifically electromagnetic pulses. And I guess scientifically, if you get high levels of electromagnetic radiation in the atmosphere, that can mess up or shut down electronics. They saw something like that all the way back in 1859 when they had a major solar storm, biggest solar storm we've had in centuries, that knocked out large portions of the telegraphs across the United States and Europe. Now, 1859, the telegraphs was about the most advanced electronics you had to worry about.
Right.
But they've made the point that a similar solar storm today would be like world-ending, cataclysmic, because like the iPhones, the computers, right, all these things just don't work. And then this Air Force report brings up the standpoint that it's a little theoretical at this point, but there are governments around the world that are thinking that you can mimic the effects of a solar storm by detonating a nuclear bomb high in the atmosphere. The Americans tried it in 1962, where they detonated a nuclear bomb about 250 miles above the Pacific Ocean, and it knocked out streetlights and other electronic systems 800 miles away in Hawaii. Mm. And that bomb was fairly small compared to some of the ones they have today. And so the Air Force is saying this: if you could detonate a nuclear bomb like maybe 300 miles above North America, there's a good chance it could mimic that solar storm you had in 1859 and knock out the electronics to the entire continent. And then they're bringing up this possibility that if like North Korea or Russia or Iran was able to do that, our military's Achilles heel is technology. If the electronics don't work, we've got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Which comes full circle back around to that 1995 article. We've run it a couple different times. It was originally published in 1995. I don't think that version's online, but I think we have a 1999 version and a 2005 version online. But saying that, it's highlighting a verse in Ezekiel, specifically Ezekiel 7, verses 14 through 15. And this is a verse applying to the end time nations of Israel, or America and Britain primarily, where it says, "They have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to the battle. For my wrath is upon the multitude thereof. The sword is without, and the pestilence and the famine within. He that is in the field shall die by the sword, and he that is in the city, famine and pestilence shall devour him." And Mr. Fleury's make this point, talking about the trumpet goes to war, and it seems like everybody's expecting the military to go to war, but nothing happens. And then that's where he's linking it into the over-reliance on technology. They have something like a cyber attack, a solar storm, a nuclear blast high in the atmosphere knocks out the electronic communication systems. You sound the trumpet, you start hitting keys on a keyboard, but nothing happens. The battalions don't get the communications. At these days, I don't know much about tanks, but I doubt they have a manual ignition anymore. There's probably a button you push to fire up the electronics that makes those things work.
I would think every aspect of our military gets back to how much is actually physically operable without electricity.
Right. So, I mean, and that's what's getting back to this Achilles heel is you'll even get people right into the program who are students of Bible prophecy and who believe Bible prophecy and still have a hard time struggling that how is the European Union's pathetic military going to take out the United States? But because United States, they trust in this huge edifice they've constructed. But I mean, if God wanted to, I mean, it's one big solar flare and a blinding flash of light, your entire military might equals nothing.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. It doesn't even necessarily have to be an enemy that enacts this. I just think, considering how difficult it would be to test a weapon like this and know exactly what the effects were going to be, a foreign power would be taking a major risk carrying out such an attack, because if it didn't work, right, then the United States would be in ample position to be able to respond with catastrophic force But like you said, it could even be a solar flare.
Yeah, because we've mentioned that verse before in Micah about God says, I will cast down your strongholds and throw down your cities. And of course, God uses human instruments all the time, so it's not saying it couldn't be a cyber attack or an EMP attack, but there would be a certain irony if it was just a blast of the sun that laid America's military desolate and then let foreign enemies take it from there.
Yeah. Well, this really does lead well into our next story. If you want proof of just how determined America's enemies are, if there's any question about whether or not they would actually use a weapon like this, consider another report out this month regarding Chinese cyber attacks against the U.S. Navy. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was just a really chilling report that the Wall Street Journal published on December 14th. And it showed that over the last 18 months, Chinese hackers have waged and targeted, they've waged a really targeted campaign on U.S. Navy contractors. And they've successfully stolen highly sensitive classified information from them. The most worrying and serious breach resulted in the theft of design plans for a new supersonic anti-ship missile that the Navy was developing for use on U.S. submarines. The hackers were able to steal 614 gigabytes of confidential data about these missiles from the network of an unnamed Navy defense contractor. And then there was a separate report out on Thursday, just yesterday, saying that Chinese hackers have also stolen personal data from more than 100,000 U.S. Navy members, which, you know, that just opens up the door for all kinds of blackmail and coercion, things like that, it's hard to even anticipate what exactly could be done with that. So the cost and the implications of China stealing all of this information are enormous. And so far, the U.S. has not officially blamed China for the attacks, at least not the ones related to the theft of that missile data. But the evidence shows that some of these attacks originated from a computer, from a computer network in Hainan Province, China. And then the specific tools used to breach the networks are also known to have been used in previous attacks by Chinese-affiliated hacking organizations. So China's fingerprints are all over it.
So how much can we point to the government being behind this, the Chinese government?
In a situation, in a country like China, you don't really have that many rogue operatives. You know, China doesn't have that much crime just because the government is so heavy-handed in dealing with it. So almost anything like this, we should not mistake as just rogue citizens operating on their own behalf or as companies operating without the government green light. This is from the top down. This is with the full approval of the government. So it should be viewed really as the Chinese Communist Party organizing all of these kinds of attacks.
It's amazing to think of these stories going back to what Gerald Fleury was writing in the early 1990s, pointing to, as you said, Andrew, Ezekiel 7:14. And, you know, there have been warnings about this for a long, long time, for decades. I mean, Gerald Fleury picked up on it because of that prophecy, but he's not the only one who's saying that the United States has made itself vulnerable because of its reliance on technology. And yet here we are, and we've only grown more reliant on it, and the consequences of an attack along the lines of what we're talking about here have only become greater than they were. I'm thinking just personally, like the idea of, say, if I've got my banking information or other sensitive information online, the idea that there's an enemy of the United States that might be accessing that information, and how might he do that, you know, how much is that actually going to impact the choices that I make as to whether to forego the convenience of using those technologies? It seems like, generally speaking, that the United States just continues to kind of stumble blindly forward, assuming that we're just going to be able to keep on doing what we're doing forever.
That's exactly right. The trends over the last several decades, both with, you know, private citizens like us and with the military, it seems, is just to be becoming more and more dependent on technology, largely because of the convenience, and more reliant on everything that's built upon cyber and other technologies.
And then there's a common thread of like all the stories we've talked about so far today is the big thing is that you just don't trust God to defend you, because you're even Jim Mattis, he's talking about, well, this pull out of Syria, we're betraying our allies, or we're not relying on our allies. But the Bible talks about like the high and defensed walls you trust in will come down. I'll throw down your chariots. I'll throw down your strongholds. The lovers you trusted will betray you. So you build up all this, I mean, walls, you've got walls, you've got military power, you've got foreign allies, and God condemns all of it. That, like I said, you trust on foreign allies, you trust on satellite defense systems, you trust on a wall on the Mexican border that may or may not exist. But at the end of it, like I said, the walls can fall down, the electronics and your military can stop working, and your allies can stab you in the back because you didn't trust me from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, do go back to the website and look at that article from Gerald Fleury, America's Achilles Heel, to get that prophetic context for what we're talking about here. Also, Jeremiah has an article, Chinese Hackers Are Stealing U.S. Navy Secrets, that explains what he was describing in his report. We appreciate that, both gentlemen. A story out of Britain this week is somewhat related. It gives us an indication of just how fragile our technology-dependent society can be, how vulnerable to disruption. For this, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, I think this does tie in pretty well. It's a small illustration of the principle that I think Andrew and Jeremiah have been talking about. So starting on Wednesday evening, there was a drone seen flying around Gatwick Airport. So this is Britain's second largest airport. It was a decent-sized drone. It wasn't, say, one of these little size-of-your-hand kind of models that they sell, but a pretty decent-sized drone. And drones of this size could take out an airliner. You know, they could get sucked into an engine, or apparently if there's some kind of a collision, they risk doing serious damage to the airplane, even potentially even bringing it down. So they decided we can't have flights while this drone is around. And so Britain's second busiest airport just ended up shut down for about 36 hours. It's open today, but still on a more limited schedule. There aren't as many flights going out as usual, and there are flights canceled. And so I think it was about 100, the figure differs from different websites, but 120,000 people having their flights affected, many of them their flights canceled. Just this airport full of people waiting to go on holiday for a really long time because there's just no planes that can take off. Apparently they said this guy seemed to know what he was doing. You know, he'd have his drone around there, and then when they started looking for it, it would disappear again. And then when they started to get ready to open the runway and allow planes out, the drone would pop up again. As far as what's out there, when I checked just a few minutes ago, they still haven't found whoever's doing this. They think that he was some kind of eco-terrorist, maybe, some kind of fight against global warming with from aeroplanes or something along those lines. But it is amazing that one guy with a drone, and that's 100,000 people that he's caused a pretty massive level of disruption for. And you look at now all of the claims that these airlines are going to have to pay out, and all of these delays, and it's a substantial hit to the economy.
It definitely is a similar story as what we were just hearing from Andrew and Jeremiah. And that's we were talking about Ezekiel 7:14, but that's not the only prophecy that shows how America and Britain are suffering these kinds of curses from common problems, the sin within our nations causing these kinds of curses.
That's right. So in Leviticus 26, God gives a list of curses that he'll send upon our nations. Well, some blessings if we obey him, and some cursings if we don't. And you know, the cursings are things like, you know, you will flee before your enemies, you'll flee when none pursues you, I'll appoint over you terror, you'll live in fear. But it also talks about, well, if you obey God, just a few of you, a handful of you will chase 10, chase 100. But if you disobey, it'll be the other way around. Just, you know, many of you will be chased by just a few of your enemies. And you know, that's exactly the case with some of these things like cyber weapons. Just a few people with the right tools, the right equipment, the right ingenuity can cause problems for the entire nation. In some cases, you know, like we heard from Andrew and Jeremiah, really serious nation-threatening problems. In this case, you've got something. You've got that same kind of principle demonstrated on a much smaller scale. Someone through some clever use of technology, you've got one guy causing this disruption for hundreds of thousands. And of course, it's not coming anywhere near threatening the United Kingdom. But you have, you know, one individual just able to disrupt so much for so many people. And like I said, that's what Leviticus 26 talks about, and that's the principle, one of the principles behind all of these things that we've just talked about in this half.
All right. Well, we appreciate that very much. Richard, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, an amazing analysis about Russia and China that backs up prophecies Herbert W. Armstrong made decades ago, Kosovo forming its own army, how Australia's prime minister managed to offend just about every Jew and Arab in the Middle East, and the fact that Presbyterians in America are now outnumbered by witches. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
What is bringing Russia and China together? Western experts have been saying for decades that this alliance will never happen, but it's happening in a major way. A recent analysis explains why. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this is a report by Graham Allison. He's the Douglas Dillon Professor of Government at the Harvard Kennedy School, and he's also the author of Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? So Allison is just a very well-regarded China expert, and he wrote an analysis this week. It was published in National Interest about China's relationship with Russia. And it just really highlights how unbelievably close these two nations have become. And he says that they've both formed a grievous coalition against the United States. And for China's part, China's grievous toward the U.S. because their so-called century of humiliation only ended after the Communist Party had crushed the Nationalist Party in that civil war back in the 40s, and the United States backed those nationalists and continues to arm them in their, you know, their island stronghold of Taiwan. So China's very upset about the U.S.'s role in all of that. And then Russia, for its part, we know that Russian President Vladimir Putin has called the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And he and many Russians see America as the main cause of that collapse. So both Russia and China are more and more upset at the United States, and they're just leaning on each other to an increasing degree. And Allison says that Russia and China now have, quote, produced an increasingly thick and consequential alignment, or what some are even calling a functional military alliance. So this functional military alliance, it's most evident in all of those massive joint war games regularly held by the two nations, which we speak about quite often on the Trumpet Hour. And Allison points out that another huge development in this story is that Russia's long-held fears about sharing its most advanced weapons technology with China have now dissipated. You know, for many years, Russia was afraid that China would steal that technology if they let them see too much of it and eventually even use it against Russia. But now Russia has not only sold China its most advanced air defense systems, the S-400, but they're even entering into joint research and development projects with China regarding things like rocket engines and unmanned aerial vehicles. So it really is becoming a functional military alliance, even if it's not an official treaty-bound alliance at this point.
And it is primarily in response to the grievances against the United States. That is really interesting. So you look at what this man is saying and what experts are generally acknowledging today, and that was not the case for many decades when Russia and China were really hostile to one another, and yet there was one man who was saying that this was going to happen all along.
That's right. Yes, Graham Allison you know, he emphasizes that this is it's really happening in defiance of long-held conventional wisdom in the West. It defies all of the predictions that most think tanks and policymakers in the Western world were making about Russia and China. And the main reason so many experts doubted that Russia and China would align is just because of how much bad blood there is between them. You know, throughout the 1950s, China and what was then the Soviet Union were mired in conflict about the border that they share and about how communism should best be implemented around the world. By the late 60s, those arguments had escalated into a war so serious that it threatened to trigger a nuclear conflict. The war never went nuclear, we know, but more than two decades of deep mistrust and bitterness between Russia and China ensued. So in light of all that history, it never seemed logical that Russia and China would be able to form a meaningful coalition. But even during that time of hostility and tension, as you said, there was one man who said, nevertheless, despite what we're seeing right now, they will draw close. And that was Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, who was editor-in-chief of The Plain Truth. That's the Trumpet's forerunner magazine. And he maintained that they would lay aside all those differences and form a close partnership. He wrote about it as far back as 1934, and then again in 1959 and 1962, which are times when Russia and China, you know, really hated each other. So even when it looked like a very illogical forecast, Mr. Armstrong just stuck to his guns there in saying that Russia and China would become close partners. And at the time of his death, the relationship between them remained really icy, but the development since then, as this Graham Allison analysis shows, it really vindicates everything that Mr. Armstrong prophesied there.
Well, that is quite amazing to see. You can read more about this in Jeremiah has an article on thetrumpet.com called Report Russia and China Forming Grand Alignment of the Aggrieved Against the U.S. You can look at the prophecies themselves in our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that explains why Herbert Armstrong prophesied that this is exactly what would happen in Asia. And another resource that is an excellent one to check out, looking at just how events have vindicated Herbert Armstrong's prophecy, is his booklet, He Was Right. He talks about, we actually went through his old Plain Truth articles and the many, many prognostications that he made based on biblical prophecy, and showed how all of those are coming to pass in events today. And it's extraordinary to look at that and to read just how much he was saying decades ago is coming to pass right before our eyes. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has talked about how Germany almost single-handedly helped eliminate an old enemy by dividing up the Balkans, former Yugoslavia. Well, we saw some of these same tactics in play this week in Kosovo, one of the nations in that region. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
I feel a bit about the Balkans the same way Churchill talked about Kremlinology. It's hard to know what's happening. You see a lot of it's like dogs fighting under a carpet, he said. It's hard to know what's going on. There's a lot of noise and barking, and you only know who's winning until the bones come flying out. Hmm. There's a lot going on, and then every now and again something makes the headlines, and we have a bit of news, but then it's hard to know exactly what's behind that. So over the last week or so, the big news is that Kosovo has voted to create an army, a standing army. So Kosovo used to be part of Serbia. They declared independence unilaterally. That declaration was not accepted by Serbia and by a very large part of the international community. The United States and NATO bombed Serbia into submission, basically, to get them to leave Kosovo alone.
At Germany's behest.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But Serbia still didn't recognize Kosovo's independence, but, you know, de facto, they were allowed to get on and run their own things. And as part of the UN-brokered arrangement that ended that, Kosovo was banned from having an army, and they haven't had one ever since. They had... there was the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, and that had links to all kinds of dodgy organizations. It also had strong links to Germany, and that's where they got a lot of their weapons from. And that was the agreed peace. So that's been the status quo until this week, until the last week or so, where Kosovo voted to bring back their army or to create an army. And this has been really controversial. Obviously, Serbia is up in arms against it. They're threatening invasion. It's split NATO. Germany has spoken strongly in favor. They've said, yes, they have the right to have their own army. They're a sovereign state. The United States has spoken strongly in favor. However, Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, sounded much more against it, which, you know, if Germany and the U.S. are in favor of it, it doesn't really matter, I guess, what the rest of NATO thinks normally. But, you know, they're divided on it. At Serbia's behest, Russia is bringing this up at the UN Security Council. And it's just brought the Balkans and brought the place of most recent conflict in Europe back onto everyone's radar, back onto the agenda, and, you know, threatened potentially even a renewed outbreak of that conflict there.
Well, wouldn't you say it's hard to view, say, Germany's support of this move without looking at what Gerald Flory was saying back when Kosovo first declared independence? And it really was Germany that pushed that through and enabled Kosovo to do that. And that really, Gerald Flory went so far as to say that was the first victim of World War III, or that was already Germany beginning its conquests that it would undertake for World War III.
Yes, I mean, Germany's interest and work in this area in recent time, I mean, it goes before Kosovo, going back to the early 1990s when Croatia and Slovakia wanted independence from Yugoslavia. And, you know, it almost single-handedly managed to, with the help of the Vatican as well, push that independence through. You know, they wanted to break away from Yugoslavia after the end of the Cold War, and America was against it. Initially, Britain was against it. France was against it. Russia was against it. Just about everyone who was anybody was against it, apart from Germany and apart from the Vatican, that spoke out very strongly in favor of Croatian independence. And they eventually managed to bring the whole rest of the world round. People didn't want to breach with Germany at the time. The European Union didn't want to breach with Germany. And they got their way, and they got NATO really behind them. And then you had exactly the same thing happen again when Kosovo split off from Serbia. And they were the ones that were really did a lot of work in bringing NATO around. I mean, the United States then did the actual work for Germany, the actual bombing of Belgrade, and splitting off Kosovo. And then that had huge geopolitical ramifications. I mean, we heard Jeremiah just talking about this alliance of grievances. And one of Vladimir Putin's biggest grievances against the United States is that the United States helped break up Yugoslavia and helped split Kosovo off from their allies, the Serbs. And they felt humiliated and ignored over that. So this whole situation, it's, you know, to see Germany once again forcefully talking about recognizing a Kosovo army over there is just really interesting. And it is a strong reminder of that history. I mean, Kosovo until recently has been one of the main locations for Germany's overseas deployment. They had thousands of troops mm-hmm. in Kosovo, and they've been drawing some of that down. And so, you know, now I wonder if they're backing this because they feel that it allows them to create a proxy army that's very loyal to them, considering everything that they've done for Kosovo. I think it's also important to consider this in terms of the border changes that have been discussed over the course of this year, where Kosovo and Serbia have been talking about partitioning the region. Kosovo even talking about rejoining or joining with Albania, because a lot of Kosovars are Albanian, ethnic Albanians. And then all of this threatens to reopen a whole lot of conflicts. So I'm sure this also just reflects some of the negotiations and maneuverings going on behind the scenes. But this is an area where you have a whole load of great powers colliding. But yeah, it really has been just a clear demonstration over the last 20 years or so of Germany's power, and then Germany acting aggressively in its own interest. They're great at talking, you know, about America First being terrible? Are we always work in harmony with the international community? And Kosovo is just an excellent example of them acting very forcefully in their own interests and completely ignoring the international community.
Well, we do have an article coming online at thetrumpet.com about Germany supporting creation of a Kosovo army. We also would encourage you to check out that booklet by Gerald Fleury, Germany Conquers the Balkans, that just puts all of Germany's moves there in that region in its prophetic context and historical context as well. We appreciate you giving us that peek under the rug at the dogs fighting there, Richard, and we'll keep our eyes on that. It's a region that we just cannot afford to take our eyes off of. We do thank you for bringing that to us. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. 2 months ago, Australia's prime minister said he would consider following U.S. President Donald Trump's example and move his nation's Israel embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But what looked to be a gesture of support to Israel turned into something quite different. For this, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Understandably, this story got a lot of coverage here in Israel because most Israelis, I think the poll, it sits at about 80 or 85%, believe that Jerusalem should be and is the united capital. Well, the united Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And so it's really a no-brainer. And whenever you see international or other nations that are confirming this fact, such as Mr. Trump, it's just really welcomed. And so when Israelis heard that the Israeli prime minister was considering moving the embassy to Jerusalem, no doubt they were excited. I mean, Israel and Australia have a very close relationship. Mr. Netanyahu traveled down there for the first time last year. Israel had a huge part in the establishment of, during the First World War, of the conquering of this territory, the conquering of Jerusalem, to allow even the Jews to have a shot at the land, having a state. And so the relationship goes back. And so it was natural to see that once Mr. Trump did it, that Australia would be this next nation to come forward. But that's not how it ended up. There was the announcement last week that instead of recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, the prime minister decided to only recognize West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and the embassy is not going to be moved to West Jerusalem yet. The embassy will be moved to West Jerusalem when there is a final peace deal with the Palestinians. And by saying this, that Israel can claim the capital, or that West Jerusalem is the capital, in a de facto way, it is giving East Jerusalem to the Palestinians. And so what was meant to be a gift turned into be something very much the opposite for Israelis.
So essentially by dividing Jerusalem the way that the Australian Prime Minister did, he's kind of presupposing that city is going to be divided. Is this the first time that we've seen that kind of a move by an international leader like this?
There was one other nation that actually did what Australia did without the fanfare. That was Russia. They tweeted, I guess it was about 3 months ago, that they consider West Jerusalem, and always have considered West Jerusalem, to be the capital of Israel. That they had a tweet, and Australia decided to have this big old celebration about the thing, which just really blew back in their face because they didn't please anyone by it. The Palestinians are upset because it's saying that Israel has a right to any part of Jerusalem. All the Muslim nations in the area of Southeast Asia, they are upset by this as well, and it hurt their ties. And then the Israelis are upset by this also. But what's, I think, more significant about this than Australians probably not really understanding the situation on the ground, because basically by saying that West Jerusalem is the capital, that means the Wailing Wall, that means the Temple Mount, that means the Old City, that's not part of Israel. That's actually part of the future Palestinian state. And so if they're going to divide it between on the 667 lines, ceasefire lines. But what this, as far as in terms of Bible prophecy, why this is important is because the Bible actually does talk about how Jerusalem is going to be divided, and how this is a really important and obvious thing that we can be watching for in terms of where we are in the timeline of Bible prophecy. And if you have these outside nations, really giving legitimacy to this idea, it is going to further motivate the Palestinians to recognize the fact that everyone else believes this is our sovereign right. So why don't we just take it? And that's what we expect to happen going forward. And so if more countries come out like this, as basically Israel said, Australia, we wish you hadn't said anything, because it is giving a divided Jerusalem legitimacy. And that is something Bible prophecy says will take place.
Well, if you want to look at this in biblical prophecy, do get our booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. You can find that on the literature tab there at thetrumpet.com. We thank you for that, Brent. Religion in America is changing, including the rise in New Age spirituality among millennials. It's having a very interesting effect on the demographics of religion in the United States. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, that quite a shocking headline is that witches now outnumber Presbyterians in the U.S. This comes from new data from the Pew Research Center saying self-identified practitioners of witchcraft, including neo-pagans, Wiccans, followers of Native American religions, followers of Eastern mysticism, all sudden together, there's about 1.5 million of them in the United States. And then with Presbyterianism being one of the Protestant denominations in decline, there's only 1.4 million of them. And there's some irony to the headline in that the Presbyterians were one of the denominations that the Puritans came out of. And, you know, like early American history, it's very famous with the Salem witch trials and all that, with this reform movement of Puritans and Anglicans cracking down on witchcraft. And now there's actually more witches in the United States than Presbyterians.
And leave it to you, Andrew, to pick up on the historical ramifications.
But it is interesting. There's a verse we've already alluded to, so I won't dwell on it, in Micah 5, verses 10 and 12, about God cutting off Israel's war horses and casting down their strongholds. But he says there in verse 12 that I will cut off witchcraft out of the land, and you will have no more soothsayers. And so witchcraft in America is something God's very concerned with. Now, this is 0.5% of the population, but as longtime listeners of this program will know, while there might be a small portion of the United States that follows straight up witchcraft, the pagan practices of witchcraft have hybridized themselves and mixed themselves into mainstream Christianity today being a blend of God's truth and what the Bible calls witchcraft. And so I'll just end this segment with by advertising a book by Herbert W. Armstrong called Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, which just really unrattles how much witchcraft has rubbed off on even the many mainstream Christian denominations today, and how you can extract that part of your religion from your life.
Well, that's a very good point. I appreciate that very much, Andrew. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com and get links to all the articles and literature we discussed today. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Good to be here.
It's always a privilege.
Thanks very much.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of G.K. Chesterton. The reformer is always right about what is wrong. He is generally wrong about what is right. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.